chapter as one of the many elements the program coordinated, and always under the supervision of senior CIA officers. Phoenix operations ranged from small units on snatch-and-snuff missions to Milai-style cordon and search operations involving hundreds of American and Vietnamese soldiers, special police officials, and psychological warfare, Psywar teams. In their pursuit of communist political cadres, senior Phoenix officials conducted operations in Cambodia, Laos, and North Vietnam, as well as in South Vietnam. As Colonel Douglas Dillard revealed to me, they even had the authority to call in massive airstrikes. From mid-1968 until mid-1969, Dillard, under the guidance of Jim Ward, the CIA's region officer in charge, coordinated Phoenix operations in the Delta region of South Vietnam. Dillard told me that he and Ward had the authority to call in B-52 strikes on targeted groups and individuals. The idea was that if we knew their pattern, and if we could put the fear of God in them, then we could influence their movements, so they could never assemble as a battalion, Dillard explained. We continued to try to do that from the summer of 1968 on, and we started getting in some pretty good defectors because of that pressure. The overall coordination was working. Indeed, and this is important in understanding Bob Carey's mission, coordination at every level of the Phoenix program was absolutely essential. For example, the CIA could not run a small unit operation in enemy territory without first consulting its military associates, because, as Dillard put it, it's conceivable that the operations people have scheduled a B-52 strike in that area. In a thesis he wrote for Air University in 1974, titled The Future Applicability of the Phoenix Program, CIA officer Warren Milberg described a typical Phoenix operation involving several U.S. Army infantry companies. The operation was conducted in the village of Tuong Tsa in Quang Tri province in early 1968. As Milberg noted, Tuong Tsa had served as a staging area for the Viet Minh in the First Indochina War, and its inhabitants still supported the communists. However, according to Milberg, the villagers' support for the communists had been coerced through atrocities and armed propaganda, and therefore the Americans had no choice but to save the villagers from themselves. The decision to conduct a Phoenix operation of massive proportions against Tuong Tsa was made by the Province Security Council at the direction of Milberg's boss, Bob Brewer, the CIA's province officer in charge. Brewer functioned like a warlord, and once permission was granted, only the barest essential information was given to the various Vietnamese agencies in Quang Tri, Milberg wrote. Cutting out the Vietnamese was designed to prevent local officials on the VC payroll from interfering with the planning process. To further ensure security, the actual name of the targeted village was not released to the Vietnamese until the day before the operation. In preparing the Tuong Tsa operation, information from South Vietnamese Police Special Branch informers, along with information from Province Interrogation Center, PIC, reports, was fed into the Phoenix program's newly established District Intelligence and Operations Coordinating Centers, DIOCCs, near Tuong Tsa. A blacklist of suspected VCI was compiled in Quang Tri's Province Intelligence and Operations Coordination Center, PIOCC, and then cross-checked against Master Phoenix lists at the Phoenix Directorate in Saigon to ensure that high-level CIA penetration agents were protected. Before the operation, Provincial Reconnaissance Unit, PRU, teams, advised by U.S. Marines detached to the CIA, were sent to locate and surveil targeted communist cadres known as members of the Viet Cong Infrastructure, VCI. Escape routes were studied for ambush sites, and local U.S. Army and Marine units were conscripted to act as a blocking force to seal off the village, just as happened at My Lai on 16 March 1968. At dawn on the day of the Phoenix operation in Tuong Tsa, U.S. military aircraft dropped thousands of Psywar leaflets on the village, urging the targeted VCI to surrender and offering rewards to defectors and informers. All that happened at My Lai, too. None of the villagers took advantage of the deal. Instead, the residents braced for the shock. In the early morning hours, the PRU counter-terror teams, accompanied by special branch interrogators and CIA advisors like Milberg, started searching people's homes for weapons, documents, food caches, and VCI suspects. As Milberg noted, the special police and its CIA advisors compared the names and descriptions on the blacklists with every man, woman, and child in Tuong Tsa. Suspects were sent to screening zones where they were interrogated, while people identified as innocent bystanders were fed and entertained by RD Cadre Psy War teams. The VCI, meanwhile, were driven into the northeast corner of town, where they were killed or captured as they tried to escape through Milberg's ring of steel. The result was two VCI captured. One was the district party chief, the other was the chief of the local National Liberation Front Farmers Association. Both were sent to the CIA's brutal interrogation center in Da Nang. Eight other targeted VCI were killed or escaped. Two Psy War teams stayed behind to assert the puppet government's presence. But within a month, they were driven out of town and Tuong Tsa reverted to communist control. As a result of such costly failures, which depleted resources without producing spectacular body counts, the CIA turned to small, unilateral operations like the one Bob Kerry conducted. The military initially resisted on moral and legal grounds. General Bruce Palmer, commander of the 9th Infantry Division in the Mekong Delta, objected to the involuntary assignment of American soldiers to Phoenix. He did not believe that people in uniform who are pledged to abide by the Geneva Conventions should be put in the position of having to break those laws of warfare. Despite the hesitancy of conventional military commanders, U.S. Special Forces, including Navy SEALs, have no compunctions about killing civilians. As Frank Snapp noted, as mentioned above, small unit Phoenix operations proliferated and took the law such as it was into their own hands. They also proved to be the most efficient way of waging a counterinsurgency. Today, under CIA guidance and coordination, U.S. Special Forces and the military's legion of unaccountable mercenary contractors have become the de facto policemen of the American empire, and each branch of the military has created its own commandos to conduct such extra-legal operations. It's the new wave. But counter-subversion is a police responsibility, and as the American agency mandated to work with foreign special police forces, the CIA will always manage Phoenix-style assassination programs, with the military providing the manpower to staff them in America's colonies around the world. Blaming the victim. To his credit, Seymour Hersh was correct when he said the original moving targets were members of the Ba'ath Party. But he studiously avoided putting either the Vietnam War or the Iraq War in its proper context. He ignored the overarching fact that the CIA's assassination programs in Iraq and Vietnam were both illegal precisely because they targeted civilians. He didn't mention the network of CIA interrogation centers and special police informant programs upon which pacification depends. Nor did he mention that American war managers, through administrative detention laws, denied targeted Iraqi and Vietnamese civilians due process in their own country as part of the Phoenix model the CIA applies in every nation the U.S. conquers and corrupts. Hersh did focus on the problems caused by faulty information, but he omitted a significant gory detail, that based on the word of an anonymous informant, Ba'ath Party members who had never harmed a single American were detained indefinitely and tortured until they confessed or became double agents, spreading CIA propaganda. Instead, Hersh focused on soldiers who escaped the dragnet. He did not accuse U.S. Commander Stanley McChrystal of systematic war crimes related to the political cleansing that preceded the reconstruction of Iraq, nor did he call the task force hit teams death squads, or name the war criminals who ran the murder machine at McChrystal's headquarters 50 miles north of Baghdad. Something else Hersh failed to mention, anyone who resisted the American invasion was put on the CIA's hit list, not just former Ba'ath Party members. Nor was the murder of those people a mistake arising from faulty intelligence, as Hirsch suggested. It was and is policy. As the CIA learned in Vietnam, killing specific targets doesn't terrorize an entire population into submission. Only indiscriminate mass murder can achieve that ghastly goal. Phoenix, according to Hirsch, was on everyone's minds in late 2003. He said that many of the anonymous officials he interviewed were afraid the preemptive manhunting strategy would turn into another Phoenix program. But that's not true. The officials planning the war within the Bush regime, including Phoenix veteran John Negroponte, knew exactly what the consequences of preemptive manhunting would be. They had every intention of using the Phoenix model to permanently fracture Iraq society, rule it through a regime of corrupted collaborators, and then steal all its oil wealth. Hirsch never characterizes American military aggression as a function of capitalism and imperialism. The trick for journalists like Hirsch was to cover up the plan using cherry-picked interviews that follow the CIA script. For example, one anonymous Pentagon advisor Hirsch interviewed justified preemptive manhunting by asserting that America's leaders had to stop the 9/11 terrorists from striking again. In other words, America had no choice. But as Hirsch strikingly neglected to mention, Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. The Iraqis were terrorists only in the sense that they resisted the American occupation of their country. They hadn't even had WMDs. Hirsch never says anything about the CIA or special forces as instruments of an unstated but intentional policy of systematic and sustained war crimes. There is always, in his reporting, a justification for what Americans do. They can be misled, and sometimes they mislead, but only when the nation's survival is at stake. In a final apologetics tour de force, Hirsch exonerated his American sources for any mistakes that were made. In choosing targets, he said in regard to Phoenix, the Americans relied on information supplied by South Vietnamese army officers and village chiefs. The operation got out of control. Even for a craftsman like Hirsch, this generalization was a nifty piece of disinformation. As Milberg noted above, the CIA excluded its Vietnamese counterparts from Phoenix planning. But the operations failed anyway, and not because the communists had coerced the people, as Milberg claimed, but because the people supported them. Hirsch failed to note that the Americans were fully aware much of the incriminating information they were fed was false. But as this book has shown, their system was geared to work that way. The CIA deliberately jerry-rigged the Phoenix program so it would overflow with false confessions and accusations, precisely so it could get away with mass murder and terrorizing the population. What a writer doesn't say is often more important than what he or she does say. In this regard, Hirsch did not mention that as soon as American soldiers started fighting and dying in Iraq, they cultivated grievances against the Iraqis, who hated them for kicking down their doors, invading their homes, and carting off their men to torture chambers. American war managers always factor this inevitability into their schemes. Why don't journalists acknowledge it? William Calley and his men blamed every Vietnamese man, woman, and child for the deaths of their comrades, which is why the majority of Americans refused to condemn them for massacring hundreds of civilians in My Lai. This is what makes America exceptional. Our lives have value, others don't. It's that double standard that enables the American war machine to cut a swath of righteous savagery across the Muslim world and for the media to characterize it as protecting the American people from terror. This places me among those who say it. Some of America's top leaders do have evil intentions. Those who planned the war on Iraq knew that war crimes like the My Lai massacre would proliferate in Iraq just as they had in Vietnam, and for all the same reasons. The CIA is their increasingly not-so-secret instrument for carrying out many of those evil plans, including a long and well-documented history of well-concealed programs that result from the mass murdering of civilians whose beliefs the war managers hate and whose wealth they covet. And over the course of the CIA's criminal career, it has relied on journalists like Hirsch to never tell that part of the story. In their corrupt world of anonymous sources and quid pro quos, Americans never have evil intentions. Quoting one of his stable of anonymous sources, invariably tough guys who talk like John Wayne, Hirsch perpetuated the myth that the Iraqis attacked us first. "The only way we can win is to go unconventional," Hirsch quoted one of his patent heroic American sources as saying. "We're going to have to play their game. Guerrilla versus guerrilla, terrorism versus terrorism. We've got to scare the Iraqis into submission." All this BS served its intended purpose. It made Hirsch's audience of pseudo-intellectuals, middle-class liberals, and compatible leftists feel good, thinking that America was a victim and had no choice but to resort to terrorism. Men in Black. In a concerted effort to scare an entire population into submission, the CIA went unconventional in Vietnam, establishing Phoenix centers and conducting selective terrorism in each of the country's 240 districts. The stated policy was to replace the bludgeon of B-52 bombings and My Lai-style search and destroy operations, which had alienated the people, with the scalpel of assassinations of selected VCI. Phoenix co-creator Robert Comer called this the rifle shot approach. Much of this terrorism was the result of unilateral CIA counter-terror operations. As Dinh Thuong An noted in his series of articles in 1970 and 1971 about Phoenix for Tin Sang, Phoenix was a series of big continuous operations which destroy the countryside and put innocent people to death. In the sky are armed helicopters, but on the ground are the black uniforms, doing what they want where the helicopters and B-52s do not reach. "Americans in black uniforms," said An, "are the most terrible." An could have been writing about the SEAL Team mission former Nebraska Governor and Senator Bob Kerry led into Tang Phong Village on the night of 25 February 1969. During that mission, Kerry and his seven-man squad murdered in cold blood more than a dozen women and children, as reported by Gregory Vistica 32 years later. To make matters worse, the SEALs lied about it when they got back to their Navy base. Kerry reported that they had killed 21 Viet Cong guerrillas in a terrible battle and received a Bronze Star in return. The CIA's strategy of using systematic war crimes was christened Contra Coup by its creator, CIA officer Ralph Johnson, in South Vietnam. A veteran of the Flying Tigers and notorious ladies' man whose most famous liaison was with Nguyen Cao Ky's wife, Johnson was described by one colleague as a good-looking, fast-talking snake oil salesman. In his book, The Phoenix Program, Planned Assassination or Legitimate Conflict Management, political warfare pioneer Johnson described Contra Coup as turning the communist terrorist strategy, which had proven effective, into a U.S. Saigon pacification strategy. This is the same disingenuous argument Hirsch made above, the idea that we have no choice but to adopt the enemy's use of selective terrorism and use it against them to protect ourselves. This strategy of being more terrifying than the Viet Cong was based on the belief that the war was essentially political and psychological in nature. The CIA misrepresented the war as being fought by opposing ideological factions, each side amounting to about 5% of the total population, while the remaining 90% were caught in the crossfire and just wanted the war to go away. On one side were communists, supported by comrades in Moscow and Peking. The communists fought for land reform, to rid Vietnam of American militants, and to unite the North and South, which had been split apart at the end of World War II. The other faction was composed of Americans and its GVN collaborators, many of whom were Catholics the CIA had relocated from North Vietnam in 1954. This faction was fighting to protect South Vietnam's rich political elite under the direction of quiet American businessmen. The object shared by both factions was to win the uncommitted 90% over to its side by coercion if necessary. The contra-coup strategy was adopted and advanced by Pere da Silva, who arrived in Saigon in December 1963 as the CIA's station chief. Da Silva claimed to have been shocked by what he saw. In his autobiography, Sub Rosa, he described how the VC had impaled a young boy, a village chief, and his pregnant wife on sharp poles. To make sure this horrible sight would remain with the villagers, one of the VC terror squad used his machete to disembowel the woman, spilling the fetus onto the ground. Several military and CIA veterans I spoke with had the same experience as Da Silva. Warren Milberg, for example, served his first tour in Vietnam as an Air Force security officer. He returned in 1967 as a CIA employee, at which point the scales fell from his eyes, and he began to see evidence of how the Viet Cong were operating in the hamlets. And what will always stand out in my mind was the terror and torture they used to strike fear and get compliance from the villagers. Milberg cited an event where a particular village chief's wife, who was pregnant, was disemboweled and their unborn baby's head was smashed with a rifle butt. We stumbled on this incident quite by accident within hours of its happening. I'd never seen anything like it in my life. The aforementioned Colonel Douglas Dillard had the same experience. Assigned as the senior Phoenix officer in the Mekong Delta in February 1968, Dillard, as he recalled, arrived in Canto on a Friday afternoon. The two army sergeants who had come in to be my administrative assistants met me at the airport and took me over to the compound and settled me in the CIA's regional embassy house. The next day, Dillard took a chopper to Chau Dak province on the Cambodian border. "It was my first introduction to the real war," Dillard said. "It was right after Tet, and there was still a lot of activity. The young sergeant there, Drew Dix, had been in a little village early that morning. The VC had come in and got a couple out that were accused of collaborating with the government, and they'd shot them in the ears. Their bodies were lying out on a cart. We drove out there, and I looked at that, and I had my first awareness of what those natives were up against. Because during the night, the damn VC team would come in, gather all those villagers together, warn them about cooperating, and present an example of what happened to collaborators. They shot them in the ears on the spot. So I knew what my job was. I realized there was a tremendous psychological problem to overcome in getting that specific group of villagers to cooperate in the program. Because to me, the Phoenix program required adequate, timely, and detailed information so we could intercept, make to defect, kill, maim, or capture the Viet Cong guerrilla forces operating in our area. Or put a strike on them. If either through intercepting messages or capturing VCI you could get information on some of the main force guerrilla battalion activity, you could put a B-52 strike on them, which we did in 4 Corps. It's debatable how random such introductions to VC terror actually were. As I mentioned in Chapter 6, The Afghan Dirty War Escalates, CIA officer Robert Haynes, who was serving as a deputy to Evan Parker in the Phoenix Directorate in February 1968, told Senator Brewster that CIA teams committed atrocities and made them look like the work of the VC. Such black propaganda was not uncommon. In his autobiography, Soldier, Anthony Herbert told how he reported for duty with the CIA's Special Operations Group in Saigon in late 1965 and was asked to join a top-secret Psywar program. "What they wanted me to do was to take charge of execution teams that wiped out entire families and try to make it look as though the VC themselves had done the killing. The rationale was that other Vietnamese would see that the VC had killed another VC and would be frightened away from becoming VC themselves. Of course, the villagers would then be inclined to some sort of allegiance to our side." Herbert refused to join the Black Propaganda SOG program. Not only that, he spilled the beans on one of the CIA's dirty tricks. As a result, Herbert was vilified in military circles. For above all, Americans can never be said to willfully do anything evil. They can never be said to be hypocrites either, but Station Chief Da Silva, who said the VC were monstrous, authorized the creation of small counter-terrorism teams, later renamed the PRU, to do the exact same thing and worse, to commit acts of selective terror and blame them on the VC. As Da Silva described the counterterrorism teams in the passage from his book cited above, they were designed to bring danger and death to the Viet Cong functionaries themselves, especially in areas where they felt secure. Ever suspicious of their Vietnamese counterparts, the military branches organized their own counterterrorism teams to terrorize VC in territory they controlled. The Navy had responsibility for the Mekong Delta and gave the job of creating counterterrorism teams to its nascent SEAL program, which President Kennedy authorized in 1962 and was still experimental in the mid-1960s. In the Phoenix program, I featured my extensive interview with Navy Lieutenant John Wilbur. In 1967, Wilbur arrived in Vietnam as deputy commander of SEAL Team 2, a 12-man detachment with no combat veterans in its ranks. Wilbur's SEAL team was assigned to a naval riverine warfare group and quartered in a Quonset hut at the Mito River dock facility in the middle of the Mekong Delta. Frankly, Wilbur told me, the Navy didn't know what to do with us. They didn't know how to target us or how to operationally control us. So basically they said, you guys are to go out and interdict supply lines and conduct harassing ambushes and create destruction upon the enemy however you can. Mostly we were to be reactive to and protective of the Navy's PBRs, patrol boats, river, Wilbur said. That was our most understandable and direct mission. The PBR squadron leaders would bring us intelligence from the PBR patrols. They would report where they saw enemy troops or if there was an ambush of a PBR. Then we'd go out and get the guys who did it. Knowing what to do and doing it were two vastly different things. Despite being highly trained and motivationally indoctrinated, the SEALs started out, in Wilbur's words, with the typical disastrous screw-up operations. In our first operation, we went out at low tide and ended up getting stuck in mudflats in broad daylight for 6 hours before we could be extracted. We didn't have any Vietnamese with us, and we didn't understand very basic things. We didn't know whether it was a VC cadre or a guy trying to pick up a piece of ass late at night. The only things we had were curfews and free fire zones. And what a curfew was and what a free fire zone was became sort of an administrative political decision. For all we knew, everybody there was terrible. We got lost. We got hurt. People were shooting back at us. And other times we never got to a place where we could find people to shoot at. There was a lot of frustration, Wilbur said, of having no assurance that the information you got was at all reliable and timely. Wilbur cited the time his team raided an island across from where the U.S. 9th Infantry Division was based. We surrounded the settlement that morning and came in with guns blazing. I remember crawling into a hut, which in Vietnam was a sort of shed encompassing a mud pillbox where people would hide from attacks, looking for a VC field hospital. There I was with a hand grenade with the pin pulled, my hand on my automatic, guys running around, adrenaline going crazy, people screaming, and I didn't know who the hell was shooting at who. I can remember that I just wanted to throw the goddamn grenade in the hut and screw whoever was in it. And all of a sudden discovering there was nothing but women and children in there. It was a very poignant experience. The CIA assigned Vietnamese scouts from its PRU program to Wilbur's SEAL teams as a way of improving its effectiveness. But the PRU were not trusted, and once acclimated, the SEALs worked unilaterally. Which brings us to Bob Kerry. Phoenix comes to Tan Phong. The village of Tan Phong was located in Kien Ho Province in the Mekong Delta. It was one of the places the VCI were said to control in February 1969. Crisscrossed with waterways and rice paddies, Kien Ho Province was an important rice production area for both the insurgents and the GVN. It was close to Saigon, densely populated, and one of the 8 most heavily infiltrated provinces in Vietnam. The estimated 4,700 VCI in Kien Ho Province accounted for more than 5% of the insurgency's total leadership. In Operation Speedy Express, the U.S. Army's 9th Infantry Division spent the first 6 months of 1969 rampaging through the province, obliterating villages and killing an estimated 11,000 civilians, all supposedly VC or VC sympathizers. Meanwhile, the U.S. Navy was patrolling Kien Ho's waterways, looking for guerrillas who had escaped the Army's genocidal offensive. As the Navy's unconventional warriors, the SEALs had the task of mounting Phoenix-style snatch-and-snuff operations against targeted VCI in the Delta. The Navy coordinated its anti-VCI with the Phoenix Directorate in Saigon, with Phoenix Regional Headquarters in Canto, and with the CIA's officer in charge in whatever province the operation was to occur. Coordination was necessary to make sure the SEALs were not targeting CIA double agents in the villages, as Jim Ward and Doug Dillard explained earlier. As Gregory Vistica noted in his book The Education of Lieutenant Carey, SEAL advisors were made available to the CIA's Phoenix program, and Langley used them to train Vietnamese provincial reconnaissance units. Vistica added, by 1968, it was common for complete SEAL platoons to operate with the PRU. Phoenix advisors in Kien Ho province did not report to individual military units, but were organized within MACV Advisory Team 88 as part of the CORDS program. Phoenix advisors in the province's District Intelligence and Operations Coordinating Centers, DIOCCs, wore the MACV patch and were often Army counterintelligence officers like Sid Towell involuntarily assigned to the program, see Chapter 4. As Vistica noted in his book, the head of MACV Advisory Team 88 had to coordinate the State Department's pacification program and CIA and Army intelligence. Based on information from the local Phoenix DIOCC, the MACV Team 88 commander believed the tiny coastal village of Tan Phong was a VC stronghold and that an important VCI cadre was planning a visit there. This intelligence was passed to the CIA's province officer in charge, POIC, who had cognizance over all anti-infrastructure operations in Kien Ho, and from the POIC to the CIA's region officer in charge, Jim Ward or his replacement, and from the ROIC to Navy SEAL commanders. The SEAL commanders assigned Lieutenant Bob Carey and his SEAL team the job of capturing or killing the targeted individual. It was Carey's maiden mission. He was 25. In an article written for the New York Times, Vistica recounted how the operation unfolded. Carey's group was called Delta Platoon SEAL Team 1, Fire Team Bravo, Vistica said. Unofficially, they would be dubbed Carey's Raiders, in honor of their enthusiastic commanding officer who was ready to take on Hanoi, as he had said many times, with a knife in my teeth. Only two of the men, Mike Ambrose and Gerhard Klan, had previous experience on SEAL teams in Vietnam. The others, William H. Tucker III, Gene Peterson, Rick Nepper, a medic named Lloyd Schreier, and Carey himself, were flying into the unknown. Carey's platoon was based at Cat Lo near Vung Tau, site of the sprawling RD cadre facility where the CIA trained its PRU teams. Carey's SEAL team launched their mission into the Tan Phong secret zone from the joint CIA-Navy compound at Vung Tau. They were delivered on swift boats. Everything indicates Carey's SEAL team was on a traditional Phoenix operation. The program was still under CIA control in February 1969, and the intelligence for the mission came from a DIOCC through the chain of command described above. Vistica interviewed Captain David Marion, the senior CORDS advisor in the district where Tan Phong was located. Marion's GVN counterpart, Thiet Luan Du, was a 45-year-old military officer trained at Fort Bragg in North Carolina. According to Vistica, Du designated Tan Phu District a free-fire zone, which allowed combat pilots and Navy warships to attack targets of opportunity, including people and villages, without prior command authority. Marion's intelligence, obtained from the Tan Phu DIOCC, indicated that the VCI village secretary was planning a meeting in the area at some unknown point in time. Based on that sketchy information, the preemptive manhunt for a moving target commenced. Again, it followed Phoenix SOP. Tan Phong consisted of 75 to 150 people living in groups of four or five hooches, strung out over about a third of a mile of shoreline. On February 13, 1969, according to the SEAL's after-action reports, Carey's team entered a section of Tan Phong, searched two hooches, and interrogated 14 women and small children looking for the village secretary. They departed on a swift boat the next day, then returned to the general area later that night, only to abort because of a malfunctioning radio. Carey's team performed exactly as Warren Milberg and Din Tuong An described Phoenix operations earlier in this book. The CIA always sent a small unit, the PRU or Hunter team, into a village the day before the operation to map out the village and capture people targeted for interrogation. The next day, the CTPRU team would return with the killer team to take out the larger target, the people in the village itself. The massacres were afforded plausible deniability back at headquarters, where, insofar as the only rule in psychological warfare is post your own score, the victims were identified as armed and dangerous VC guerrillas. Some important details standard to such operations are missing from Carey's story. For example, how did the SEALs conduct their interrogations? Did they have a PRU interpreter with them? Did they chop off fingers? In any event, Carey knew how the village was laid out, how many people lived there, and where they lived. All that was needed was a provocation generated through CIA black propaganda or otherwise, and such a provocation magically occurred a few days later when the VC allegedly committed an atrocity of some sort in the area, the monstrous kind Milberg, De Silva, and Dillard have described above. Once the provocation had occurred, Captain Martin and District Chief Duke responded in the usual manner. They told the villagers an operation was going to be conducted, and that anyone who wasn't gone would be considered VC and killed. And indeed, on the night of 25 February, a swift boat brought Carey and his SEAL team back to Tanfong to finish their business. The marauders moved in around midnight, and by Carey's account, the killings were committed in self-defense. According to Carey, his team stumbled on a home they hadn't noticed the first time they were in the village, even though it was on the prearranged path they had walked a few days earlier. The home was occupied, Carey said, by two lookouts. Carey ordered two SEALs to kill the lookouts using their knives, often Gerber Mark II daggers. American commandos are taught how to put their hand over the sleeping victim's mouth, slip the dagger up under the second rib through the heart, and then give it a flick so it snaps the spinal cord. Or they just slice the throat from ear to ear. Having done that, the team, according to Carey, worked their way along a dike into a hamlet consisting of four hooches. Suddenly, without warning, someone opened fire on the SEALs, who in a blind fury responded with everything they had, expending 1,200 rounds of ammunition. When the dust settled, 14 people were clumped together dead. 7 more were killed trying to flee. That's Carey's version, as reported by Vistica. According to Gerhard Klann, the most experienced SEAL on the mission, and later a member of SEAL Team 6, credited with killing Osama bin Laden, the murders were not committed in response to an ambush, but were conducted systematically in cold blood. Klann told Vistica that Carey ordered him to kill an old man, an old woman, and 3 children in the first home, the one Carey said was occupied by armed VC guerrilla lookouts. When the old man resisted, Carey kneeled on him so Klann could slit his throat. Reminiscent of a scene out of Truman Capote's book In Cold Blood, a third SEAL came to their assistance and helped kill the old woman and kids, who were now fully awake and screaming. A Vietnamese woman, Pham Tri Lan, witnessed the murders and confirmed Klann's account. She added that the old folks, Bui Van Vat and his wife, Lu Thi Khan, were the children's grandparents. Vistica confirmed they existed by visiting their graves in the village, something the New London Day could have done if it really wanted to know what really went on in the PIC Rob Simmons ran, as described in Chapter 15. Having dispatched with those 5 yellow-skinned commie simps, the heroic SEALs abandoned their preemptive manhunt for the elusive, moving VCI cadre. They knew the other villagers had heard the murdered family's screams, so according to Klann, they rounded up all the women and children from a group of hooches on the fringes of the village. Having done that, they searched their homes. Finding no arms or evidence of the political cadre they were hunting, they massacred everyone else in an attempt to conceal the murder of the 5 people in the first home, and as a psychological warfare warning to villagers in surrounding villages. Klann said they were less than 10 feet away from the people they cut down, and that Carey gave the order. Some were still crying and squirming after the first barrage. so they finished off the survivors, including a baby. As CI officer Per De Silva put it, the SEALs were monstrous in the application of murder to achieve the political and psychological impact they wanted. Then they went home and reported they had killed 21 VC. You spend half your life just covering up. It's ludicrous to think Kerry and the SEALs didn't know what they were getting into and didn't intend to murder everyone in Tan Phong. While on contract with the CIA from early 1967 through early 1969, Marine Captain Robert Slater served as director of the PIC program and chief interrogation advisor to the special police. In a 1970 thesis for the Defense Intelligence Institute titled The History, Organization, and Modus Operandi of the Viet Cong Infrastructure, Slater described the district party secretary as the indispensable link in the VCI hierarchy. As Slater explained, the district party secretary usually does not sleep in the same house or even hamlet where his family lived to preclude any injury to his family during assassination attempts. But he added, the Allies have frequently found out where the district party secretaries live and raided their homes. In an ensuing firefight, the secretary's wife and children have been killed and injured. Kerry's SEAL team targeted a village party secretary for assassination in Tan Phong, and the same result occurred. Even though they couldn't find the target, everyone present was killed, including children. This is the intellectual context in which Kerry's war crime took place. It was standard procedure to kill the target along with his family and friends. For purposes of plausible denial, you could say the others were unintended victims and collateral damage. But when you know it's going to happen, and it happens every time, consistently, over years, that threadbare excuse doesn't hold water. Omerta, the mafia's term for its sacred code of silence, alone enabled Kerry and the SEAL team to get away with the premeditated murder and mutilation of 21 defenseless people, and then report it as a fierce battle with VC. That's American military idolatry in a nutshell. Convicted of murdering 22 unarmed civilians in My Lai, William Calley was venerated as a hero and served 3 years under house arrest until pardoned by Richard Nixon. Calley's defense was to say that massacring civilians happened all the time. Bob Kerry's friend and colleague, Secretary of State John Kerry, used the same everyone-else-does-it grade school rationale to defend Kerry. Along with Senators Max Cleland and Chuck Hagel, John Kerry, then a senator, issued a statement in 2001 stating their belief that an investigation into the Tan Phong massacre would be counterproductive insofar as it blamed the warrior rather than the war. While in effect conceding that the war as a whole was criminal in character, John Kerry elaborated in one television appearance on the thesis that soldiers should not be held responsible for actions that were in accordance with the policies of the U.S. government. The raid on Tan Phong was part of Operation Phoenix, he said, and the Phoenix program was an assassination program run by the United States of America. Bob Kerry's war crime was made worse by the fact that the unarmed civilians his SEAL team murdered were prisoners. But unrepentant, Bob defended himself from that charge by claiming he was ordered not to take prisoners. He didn't want to kill those little kids. He was told to do it. Where have we heard that before? In any event, justice of a sort prevailed. On his next mission, a grenade exploded at Kerry's feet. Who put it there is not known. Is it possible that he was fragged by his fellow SEALs for some unknown reason? However the grenade got there, it blew off the lower part of a leg. Kerry's career as a killer came to a close, and he went home to weep in his mother's arms. After a few months of self-pity, Kerry began his descent into the self-deception and revisionism that accompanies war crimes. It is a process of identity recreation he shares with many veterans of Vietnam and America's neo-colonial wars since 9/11. To a large extent, as I've noted throughout the text, the success of their collective cover-up defines America's exceptionalism. Kerry's rebirth as a certified hero began when he received the Medal of Honor on 14 May 1970 A mere 10 days after the Ohio National Guard murdered 4 anti-war protesters at Kent State. The medal was a meal ticket, not unlike being inducted into the mafia as a made man. One of the protected few, Kerry was forever guaranteed fame and fortune. The only burden he carried was the grudge he held against the anti-war protesters who didn't appreciate his sacrifice. Elected governor of Nebraska in 1982, he dated movie starlet Deborah Winger, became a celebrity, and got elected to the U.S. Senate, where he served as vice chair of the Intelligence Committee. The picture of a neoliberal, he even ran for president in 1990, showering self-righteous criticism on draft dodger Bill Clinton for his penchant for lying. Kerry was no longer in government in 2001 when Klan revealed what had really happened in Tan Phong. But the ultras immediately and wholeheartedly rallied to his defense. His SEAL team, apart from Klan, closed ranks and backed his version of events. Kerry accused Klan of having a personal grievance against him and implied he was lying. Colonel David Hackworth, representing the military establishment, defended Kerry by saying there were thousands of such atrocities. Hackworth said that his own unit committed at least a dozen such horrors. He said it nonchalantly, as if he were mowing the lawn. Representing Hollywood and the propaganda industry's huge financial investment in the myth of the American war hero, Jack Valenti told the LA Times that all the normalities of a social contract are abandoned in war. By the same token, this means it is perfectly okay for terrorists to attack Western civilians because CIA officers operate in secret and cannot be located. Kerry also received support from veterans of the Vietnam Press Corps. Former New York Times correspondent David Halberstam, author of The Best and the Brightest, described the region around Tan Phong as the purest bandit country. He added that by 1969, everyone who lived there would have been third-generation Viet Cong. Clichés are the grist of revisionism at its sickest, and Halberstam's racist, anti-communist rant exposed him as nothing more than a mythmaker for the rich political elite. Halberstam might just as well have said, kill them all. Two other journalists stand out as examples of the press corps' complicity in war crimes in Vietnam. Neil Sheehan, author of the aptly titled Bright Shining Lie, confessed that in 1966 he saw American GIs slaughter as many as 600 Vietnamese civilians in 5 fishing villages. He had been in Vietnam for 3 years by then, and it didn't occur to him that he was witnessing a war crime. It was business as usual. Morley Safer is next on the list of co-conspirators. Safer vented his personal hatred for me when he wrote the half-page review in the New York Times that killed my book, The Phoenix Program, in its cradle. I wasn't surprised that the Times employed Safer to assassinate my book. In it, I'd said, when it comes to the CIA and the press, one hand washes the other. In order to have access to informed officials, reporters frequently suppress or distort stories. In return, CIA officials leak stories to reporters to whom they owe favors. At its most incestuous, reporters and government officials are actually related, like Delta PRU Commander Charles Lemoyne and his New York Times reporter brother James. Likewise, if Ed Lansdale had not had Joseph Alsop to print his black propaganda in the U.S., there probably would have been no Vietnam War. At the time of the review, October 1990, I thought Safer hated me primarily for accusing the press corps of covering up war crimes. I thought he did it for pecuniary reasons, too. Safer's self-congratulatory book on Vietnam had come out a few months before. It wasn't until 25 years later that I found out that Safer owed William Colby a favor. Safer revealed his incestuous relationship with Colby for the first time at the American Experience Conference in 2010. "I got a call to come and see Colby in his office," Safer explained, "and I walked in, and I had met him. We had no strong relationship at all, but..." And Colby said, "Look, can you disappear for 3 days?" Laughter. And I said, "I guess." Laughter. And he said, "Well, be at the airport, be at..." Inaudible. "At the airport tomorrow morning at 5:30. Bernard Kalb, the moderator, asked Safer if Colby wanted him to bring along a camera crew. "No, no," Safer replied. And I showed up, and Colby said, "Okay, here are the rules. You can see that I'm going on a tour of all the stations. You can't take notes, and you can't report anything you hear." And I spent 3 days, first of all, down in the Delta, and they were really, really revealing. There was only one meeting that he would ask me to leave the barracks, and it was fascinating because the stuff that these guys were reporting through whatever filters to you had been so doctored by the time it got to you. I mean, to this day, I still feel constrained in terms of talking about it. Colby introduced Safer to all the top CIA officers in Vietnam and introduced him to the interrogation centers and counterterrorism teams. Safer got to see how the CIA crime syndicate was organized and operated. And like Don Corleone dispensing favors in The Godfather, Colby knew that one day Safer would be obligated to return it. That is how the CIA, as the organized crime branch of the U.S. government, functions like the mafia through its old boy network of complicit media hacks. Can Bob Kerry be tried for murder? Kerry says his actions at Tan Phong were an atrocity, not a war crime. He feels remorse, not guilt. Totally rehabilitated, he has come to view Vietnam as a just war. Was the war worth the effort and sacrifice, or was it a mistake? Kerry asked rhetorically in a 1999 column in the Washington Post. When I came home in 1969, and for many years afterward, I did not believe it was worth it. Today, with the passage of time and the experience of seeing both the benefits of freedom won by our sacrifice and the human destruction done by dictatorships, I believe the cause was just and the sacrifice not in vain. At the Democratic Party convention in Los Angeles in 2000, Kerry lectured the delegates not to be ashamed of war crimes and to treat Vietnam veterans like him as heroes, not terrorists. "I never felt more free than when I wore the uniform of our country," he said without irony, and without noting that wearing the uniform made him free to murder women and children. Promulgating the militaristic business party line is the price Bob Kerry pays for getting away with mass murder. As long as he promulgates it, he is one of the protected few, entrusted with the government's top secrets. Indeed, he is one of a handful of Americans who has read the secret 28 pages on Saudi Arabia's role in 9/11. He knows where all the bodies are buried. Gregory Vistica traveled to Vietnam and visited the graves of Bui Van Vat, his wife Lu Thi Khan, and their three grandkids in Tan Phong. And now that Kerry knows where his victims are buried, he could pay his respects to the victims too. While he's in Vietnam running the Americans' Fulbright University, he could also pay a visit to the War Remnants Museum in Ho Chi Minh City. According to Wikipedia, the War Remnants Museum features a display based on the Tan Phong incident. It includes several photos and a drainpipe, which it describes as the place where three children hid before they were found and killed. The display includes the following account. The SEALs cut 66-year-old Bui Van Vat and 62-year-old Lu Thi Khan's necks and pulled their three grandchildren out from their hiding place in a drain and killed two, disemboweled one. Then the Rangers moved to dugouts of other families, shot dead 15 civilians, including three pregnant women, disemboweled a girl. The only survivor was a 12-year-old girl named Bui Thi Luom, who suffered a foot injury. One wonders if Kerry will visit the graves of the children his SEAL team disemboweled the next time he visits Vietnam. Perhaps he fears being arrested if he does. As attorney Michael Ratner at the Center for Constitutional Rights told Counterpunch, Kerry should be tried as a war criminal. His actions on the night of February 24 to 25, 1969, when a 7-man Navy SEAL unit which he headed killed approximately 20 unarmed Vietnamese civilians, 18 of whom were women and children, was a war crime. Like those who murdered at My Lai, he too should be brought into the dock and tried for his crimes. The Geneva Conventions, customary international law, and the Uniform Code of Military Justice all prohibit the killing of non-combatant civilians. The brutality of others is no justification. That is why there is a moral imperative to expose the Phoenix Program as the basis for the CIA's ongoing policy of committing war crimes. It is imperative to try the CIA officers who created it, as well as the people who participated in it, including the journalists who covered it up. If America's policy of conducting war crimes is ever to end, people of conscience must expose the dark side of our national psyche, the part that allows us to employ terror to assure our world dominance. To accomplish this, there must be a war crimes tribunal, like the one Bertrand Russell and Jean-Paul Sartre put together in 1966 to 1967. I've assembled enough evidence in this book alone to put the likes of Bruce Lawler, Rob Simmons, Frank Scotton, and Bob Kerry in the dock. The national security establishment will try to prevent it. The U.S. government has gone to great lengths to shield itself and its cadres from international law, while corrupting international institutions like the United Nations to prosecute U.S. enemies like Slobodan Milosevic. But if the U.N. could free itself from U.S. influence, it could establish an ad hoc tribunal, such as it did with the Rwanda ICTR and Yugoslavia ICTY. Alas, according to Ratner, the legal avenues for bringing Kerry and his cohorts to justice in the U.S. are limited. A civil suit could be lodged against him by the families of the victims under the Alien Tort Claims Act. There is no statute of limitations for war crimes, and under 18 U.S.C. Section 2441, War Crimes, Kerry could be sentenced to death or life imprisonment. But at the time of his crimes in Vietnam, U.S. criminal law did not apply to what U.S. citizens did overseas. Only military law applied, and now that Kerry is no longer in the Navy, the military courts have no jurisdiction over him. In yet another great irony, Kerry, as a senator, voted for the war crimes law, allowing others to be prosecuted for crimes similar to those he committed. Prosecution in Vietnam and extradition are also possibilities. Universal jurisdiction does not require the presence of the defendant. He can be indicted and tried in some countries in absentia. Or his extradition can be requested, Ratner said. Some countries may have statutes permitting this. Kerry should check his travel plans and hire a good lawyer before he gets on a plane. He can use Kissinger's lawyer. But that's not going to happen. The rule of law ended with 9/11, when legal invasions and occupations became stated policy, along with targeted assassinations and mass murder. And until the media stops glorifying preemptive manhunting of moving targets as necessary for our security, rather than fueling the terrorism that threatens the unprotected many, the war crimes will never stop. Chapter 19. Top Secret America Shadow Reward System. After Dana Priest and William M. Arkin's three-part series, Top Secret America, appeared in the Washington Post, pundits and academics began falling all over themselves in a rush to quantify the post-9/11 counterterrorism apparatus. Although few of them had seen fit to even notice the elephant in the room before, they all swooned at its $75 billion price tag, as well as the implications such a monstrous surveillance and covert action apparatus has for a free society. There were, however, dimensions to the problem that Priest and Arkin didn't dare touch upon. Let me tell you a story that fills in some of the blanks. In 1985, I was contacted by a CIA officer. Larry had served as a deep cover agent overseas for over 15 years. He'd had a breakdown and wanted to tell me his story. He'd read my book about my father, the Hotel Tacloban, and thought I'd understand. Larry's story began in South Vietnam in 1966, where, as a gung-ho Marine, he came to the attention of a CIA talent scout. The CIA officer ran a background check and discovered that Larry was an only child from a broken marriage. Larry was an emotional orphan looking for something to latch onto. He chose the ultra-conservative route. In high school, his favorite activities were attending the local Lutheran church and participating in the Rotary Club debate team. His dream was to become a self-described crusader and follow in the footsteps of his hero, John Wayne. Larry described himself as being for freedom, the American way of life, and free enterprise. Plus, he was avidly anti-communist and a combat veteran, which made him even more attractive to the CIA. Strange things began to happen. Although still a Marine, he was sent to Okinawa and given special training in scuba diving, skydiving, demolition, and the martial arts. No one told him why he was being groomed, and being a good soldier, he didn't ask. But he soon learned that the CIA had decided to turn him into a deep cover agent. At the time, the CIA's central cover staff managed a worldwide network of deep cover agents and freestanding proprietary companies. It existed, and may still exist with some new name, outside the regular CIA bureaucracy, and was used by presidents to conduct the CIA's most sensitive operations. The central cover staff concocted an elaborate cover story. Only Larry's case officer knew what was fact and what was fiction. The story went like this. Larry's father was an Australian soldier who, during a tour in the Philippines in the Second World War, had an affair with a woman whose maiden name was Valesco. His mother was half Spanish, half Filipino, from the upper class. The necessary documents were forged to prove that his mother had been a lawyer working in Zamboanga. Larry's mother and the Australian soldier were never legally married, but Larry was by birth a Philippine citizen. Abandoned by the Australian soldier, Larry's mother succumbed to depression and never recovered. She was hospitalized, and Larry was put up for adoption. At the age of 3, he was adopted by a loving foster family in America. His middle-class parents raised him as their own son, never mentioning that he was not their natural child. He was, according to the legend the CIA created, popular and smart, with an aptitude for mechanics. The CIA forged documents to show that he'd received a scholarship to the General Motors Institute for Automotive Engineering and had attended the Sloan School of Management at MIT. According to his cover story, Larry enlisted in the Marines and, based on his mechanical aptitude, was selected for helicopter pilot training. However, during the required security check, the Marines discovered that he was a Filipino citizen, not an American. This revelation came as a shock, but it also provided him with a pretext to visit the Philippines to discover his past. Larry made the trip immediately upon leaving the Marines in 1968. As outlined in the central cover staff's script, and as actually happened, Larry learned to speak the language and settled in the land of his birth. He got a job as a manager and translator with a Japanese mining company. He did well, but left that job to manage a Shell Oil service station franchise on the island of Leyte. Over the next 10 years, Larry held management positions with B.F. Goodrich, an American building and supply contractor to Clark Air Force Base, General Motors, Visa Card, and Westinghouse, which built the first nuclear reactor in the Philippines. As is true of most American multinationals, Larry's employers all knowingly provided cover for CIA agents as a way of maintaining influence overseas as well as in Washington. By 1980, Larry had established himself as an upright Filipino citizen. His cover was impeccable, and to make a long story short, he was elected to public office. While in that position, however, things went wrong. The U.S. State Department became aware that he was a deep-cover CIA officer serving in the Philippine legislature. A series of actions were taken to destroy all records of his existence, and he was whisked out of the Philippines. After Larry's breakdown, the CIA got him a job as a manager of a Playboy Club in Detroit. Later,